Riverbank Field. 1010 XL 92.5 FM presents Jaguars Today with your host Mike Dempsey and Jeff Lagerman.
Hey, welcome in, everybody. Happy Tuesday to you. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Lagerman, Fat Tony here with you at the Jacksonville Orthopedic Institute Studios here at Everbank Field. Jeffrey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good weekend of football watching for you?
Yeah, it was. It was good. It was relaxing. Probably the most football that I've watched in a very long time. I mean, because, you know, I mean, usually
on the weekend you're working
and yeah. You don't get a chance to sit back and watch. And, you know, to me, there's nothing better than the NFL when it comes to playoff football. And it was actually nice to enjoy all four games, almost in their entirety. You know, I mean, once the games kind of got, you know, out of control a little bit, I mean, sometimes I would find something better to do. But for the most part, the games were, very entertaining.
Yeah, and I think this weekend coming up, potentially, every year is the best weekend in football.
You know, it didn't surprise me. I mean, I don't think there was one game that surprised me with the exception of the Baltimore-Pittsburgh game. I really thought that Pittsburgh would have more. But, you know, I've always talked about how I have such great respect for Bruce Arians. Put John Harbaugh in that category. I mean, for what he's been able to do, especially with a football team that really wasn't playing that well down the stretch, to be able to go to Pittsburgh and then really have a swagger. And I think that that's the one thing I think that separates great coaches from others, is that certain coaches have the ability to have a team to be able to go on the road and have a swagger. And Baltimore has been able to have that swagger since he's been at the helm.
Yeah, yeah, and Flacco's been, because of that in part, and his own play, the winningest road quarterback in the NFL playoffs in history.
And I think a large part of that is because of John Harbaugh. You know, there's something about a coach that can elevate the level of play of a team when it comes to playoff time or critical moments. And, you know, we talked about how, with Blake Bortles in that game at Houston, how he had the ability to elevate his play at the critical moment. You know, and that's what you get excited about, I think, if you're a Jaguars fan. But, I mean, if you're a Baltimore Ravens fan, to have a coach that can do that and then a quarterback that can elevate his level of play in the playoffs like that, wow.
Wasn't it? I thought it was huge. You tell me if you agreed. To have Haloti Ngata back with fresh legs. I mean, Haloti Ngata gets suspended for the last month of the season.
Yeah, it helped, Mike. But I'm the guy that really just, I mean, blew me away was Terrell Suggs. I mean, the guy is, I mean, you're talking about a guy who, what is it, like in his 12th year? 11th, 12th year in the National Football League.
Sure.
Has been through an Achilles tear. And now all of a sudden he goes into the postseason and he goes to Pittsburgh and have the type of game that he had. I mean, that was an absolute monster game. I mean, that's the type of game that legends are made on. You know, and so he impressed the heck out of me. Haloti Ngata was good. The other guy on the inside, number 98, who I know that John Harbaugh was raving about, I guess prior to the game, to the broadcast crew, rightly so, because from watching him against the Jaguars, he really didn't do much at all. But I thought he was as good, if not better, than Haloti Ngata. And I'm trying to think of his name.
Who are you talking about? Jernigan?
No. Jernigan's 97.
Out. Yeah.
He was out. 98 for the Ravens. Defensive tackle.
We'll find it for you. Why do you do that to us?
I don't know. He was better than Haloti Ngata.
Baltimore gives New England fits, too.
Well,
they have.
Well,
anyway.
I mean, what is it? Baltimore's 2-1, I guess, on the road against the New England Patriots. And I think that goes back to that swagger that John Harbaugh has the ability to create with his football team. Because, you know, there's a lot of teams that would go to New England that would have a little bit of a fear factor because it's Bill Belichick and the New England Patriots and it's playoff time. And the size of the moment, I think, sometimes overcomes opponents in that situation. And it never seems to bother the Ravens. They seem to thrive on it. And that, to me, is maybe the most impressive aspect about John Harbaugh. You know, and both Harbaugh brothers. I mean, both of those guys have the ability to give a team a little bit of swagger and a little bit of an edge. But what I think is most impressive is the job that John Harbaugh has done, because I think that Ravens team has some good elements. You know, I think their offensive line, the interior, is exceptionally good. Joe Flacco obviously is exceptionally good when it comes to postseason time, but they've got some severe deficiencies in the secondary. But the guys up front, to be able to raise their level of play, and then the guys in the secondary that they have playing, which is probably third teamers in a lot of cases, maybe fourth teamers in some cases, to be able to play as well as they are, that's impressive.
Brandon Williams.
Brandon Williams.
That's your guy.
He's a heck of a football player now. Against the Jaguars and watching the film leading up to that game, he didn't really stand out. But I know that in down the stretch for the Ravens, watching him against the Texans, he was very good. So pretty much ever since Lodinata went out, he was able to raise his level of play to another level. And he rose his level of play, certainly at Pittsburgh.
When you watch the film of this Ravens team, when the Jags are getting ready to play them, did they jump out at you as a team that was significantly better than the record would indicate?
No. No.
Are they playing like that now?
I think they're playing about their record, but certain guys elevated. You know, the play of Terrell Suggs, the play of Joe Flacco, the play of Torrey Smith, the play of Marshall Yanda, a guard playing right tackle, was able to play exceptional. I mean, he's talking about a guard, an all-pro guard, moving out to tackle, and in most cases, that doesn't work out that well. But for Yanda to play as well as he did at that tackle position, I mean, that's crazy good. Crazy good.
Look at Detroit and Dallas. That was all the talk yesterday, really, the last almost 48 hours.
Yeah, and you know what? All that talk about the penalty, non-penalty, I mean, come on. I mean, that you know, you can't sit there and talk about the officiating, you know, determining the outcome of a game. Did it have an impact in a game? Sure, it had an impact on a game. But you know what? You got to be able to overcome those type of things. And to be honest with you, I watched it, and I didn't think the flag should have been thrown. I mean, this is playoff football. The way that you call games in the playoffs is different, and it's always been that way.
Should it be?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Because you make teams win it. You to me.
Right, but isn't part of winning it playing within the confines of what the rule book is set up to allow you to do?
But you get to the point where what is ticky-tacky and what is a point of emphasis
call? So you thought that was a ticky-tack.
I thought it would have been. If that call stands, that's ticky-tacky. And I know that, you know, Dean Blandino talked about the grab of the jersey and then the contact that was made. Well, the grab of the jersey didn't make or change.
Doesn't matter.
The way the offensive player moved.
But doesn't matter. I mean, the definition does not ask that question. The definition asks whether or not you grabbed it and he clearly pulled it.
Yeah, so I get that.
They would have been justified.
But it did not change the offensive player's route. It didn't change the way that his body was positioned or anything. It goes.
What about the extended arm hand on the shoulder?
Okay, well, you remember we were talking about the potential touchdown to Mercedes Lewis. It was here. And I said he should have done something to draw the penalty in that situation.
Yes.
It's the same thing. If the tight end, instead of allowing his momentum, and Jerry Austin talked about this, if the tight end is able to come back to the ball and then the contact happens, or he's trying to elevate and then the defender impedes him, then it becomes an obvious call. It's no different than the non-call to Mercedes Lewis here in the end zone. If Mercedes had gone up or back to the ball and makes a play on the ball and then it becomes more obvious, then the penalty should have been thrown. Because that play to Mercedes that was here, when I sat there and I said, Mercedes has to do more to draw the penalty in that situation. Because if you follow the rule book by the letter of the law, that was interference on the defensive back in that situation. And so to me, in playoff football, it has to be a very clear-cut call. And that was not a clear-cut call. To me, that was just old-school face guarding. Some contact happened. That's playoff football. Deal with it.
But if they don't make the call at all, I don't think anybody's really talking about it. Maybe they mention it, hey, you know, in Detroit, you know, we should have gotten that call. What about that call
right.
that was missed? But the fact that they throw a flag on pass interference, rarely do you see a pass interference flag picked up because it is a subjective call to begin with. And you've got a crew that's not working, that's working together maybe for the first time all year.
But you know, I mean, we're making too much out of this one call. Okay, Detroit, just punt the ball more than 10 yards down the field and play defense.
I get that, Jeff, but they don't have to punt the ball at all. If the penalty's called, if Dez Bryant's flagged for coming out to argue with the referee.
Yeah, but see, that to me, I mean, it's an emotional game. I mean, are you really going to throw a flag.
It's an emotional game. What if I take a swing at a guy? Right?
That's different.
That's different. Why is that over the
top?
There
are levels of being over the top.
See, you come at it from a standpoint of you think Ndamukong Suh is an angel. All right.
I don't think he's an angel. I think he's a great football player.
I know. Well, he is a great football player, but you're, status or your standpoint and your viewpoint on this pretty much,
Mike,
all season
it's
has been
football.
Let him play.
It's football.
I get that, Jeff. It is football.
There's contact involved.
Well, let's clothesline.
I mean, because you know, I just don't want to see this game become what Bill Polian had in mind years ago when he had Peyton Manning and he was on the competition committee, to where it becomes basically flag football. I mean, this is the game of football, and contact happens. And if we get to the point where it becomes ticky-tacky, it takes the fun out of the game.
Well, that's fine. Your definition of ticky-tacky and mine are different. I don't think that was ticky-tacky when, to me, Pettigrew, look, could he have sold it more?
No, see,
certainly.
Here's the thing. You said if the flag wasn't thrown, it wouldn't have been an issue.
Right.
Except for maybe in Detroit.
Right.
Okay, so.
Because we don't focus on every single play where flags are not thrown. You might be able to call a lot of penalties. The point being, you rarely see an instance where a referee makes that kind of call and then picks it up because another guy comes in.
Well, the other guy that came in is the one that had the better look at it anyway.
Says him.
Yeah.
Right. But then, well, the head of referees says, no, they should have flagged it for at least defensive holding, if not pass interference. I don't see how you can say there wasn't contact. The guy who comes in can't say there was no contact. There clearly was contact. He was wrong.
Well, there's always contact. I mean, that's the nature of the game.
Well, there's not always contact in every play when a defender is trying to defend a pass.
Are we talking about significant contact?
Are we talking about contact that violates the rules as they're written? Yes, we are. You will choose to go beyond that as a defensive player. That's fine.
There are a different set of understood rules when it comes to the playoffs. That's the way it is. It's always been that way. It will always be that way. They can have all the points of emphasis that they want in the regular season. But when it comes to playoff football, the rule book changes slightly.
Shouldn't.
And that's just the way it is.
Shouldn't.
But it's always been that way.
What is that? This call. That has nothing to do with this call. And I'm not saying this is the sole reason they lost the game. I just wanted your opinion on it. Clearly, we've gotten it. Okay? So I'm not trying to make a federal case out of this saying Detroit definitely would have won the football game had that call gone in their favor. But this isn't a case of where they were throwing flag after flag after flag about ticky-tack stuff. This is a call where, clearly, the guy pulled his jersey. Read the definition of holding.
Is this a penalty?
Yes. Yes. You just pulled Tony's sweatshirt lightly. All right.
Did you see Tony's body come forward with
doesn't
that pull?
Is that what the rule calls for?
Am I hurting you right there?
I feel violated.
What if I put my hands on Tony's face in a gentle manner right now? That's a penalty too, because I can't put my hands on his face. All right. So, you know, I don't know if we want the rest to get all
just
into...
Just because the jersey comes off of the actual way from the body.
Correct.
4 inches, you're saying that should have been a penalty?
It's the head of referees said it should have been a penalty.
Dean Blandino.
You're a player.
He's covered all his bases on that.
He's right. No, he threw his own ref under the bus by saying they missed the call. I don't think he's covering his bases.
He's trying to save face.
He can't deny that should have been a penalty in the face of obvious evidence. You can, apparently, because you play by the former player's code where, grunt, let's go out there and play football and the hell with these referees.
A terrible throw by Matthew Stafford on the play. Just an awful
terrible
throw.
Terrible decision,
that
I
had
thought.
No chance to be completed with where it was thrown. And regarding Dez Bryant, there's no other major sport in America where if a player comes off the bench to yell at an official, he's not immediately at least penalized for doing what Dez Bryant did.
If not thrown out of the game.
Right.
Right.
He probably, in the NBA, he wouldn't be allowed to play the next game.
Right.
For what
he did. And that's a different story. I don't know about that, because in the NBA, the rule is if you come off when there's a fight that breaks out. I don't know what would happen if you just lose your mind and argue a foul
call
on somebody
else. I could understand the call on Dez Bryant more so than the interference.
You could understand flagging Dez Bryant.
Yes.
Right. Whereas they say the complete opposite, almost, right? Because they say that's more of a judgment call. You don't have to
disagree with that
guy. Right, well, there you go. All right. Now, that's fine. That's your opinion. I am more of a letter of the law kind of guy when it comes to penalties. All this swallow the whistle in the last minute of a basketball game, to me, is ludicrous. If it's a foul 3 minutes into the game, it should be a foul 47 minutes.
It's not swallowing the whistle.
For a lot of people suggest that's exactly what should happen.
You just said that interference is a very subjective call.
Correct. Defensive holding's not. Not the way it's written in
the
rule.
Where was it holding?
The pulling
because
of the jersey
comes away from the body six inches.
Look, I didn't write the rule, Jeff. I didn't write the rule. I mean, you're laughing. Yeah, it's hilarious, but that's the way it's written.
To me, there has to be some kind of impeding the progress with.
But the example we're using, basketball, every foul is a subjective call to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. How much?
Well, the NBA. Well, you can't compare the NBA to the NFL.
But I'm talking about the perception of officials needing to call games differently depending on the circumstances. I've always thought that.
I've watched
insane.
The NBA in somewhat of a limited fashion. And I can't figure the officiating out in the NBA. So I have.
Well, You're the guy who just doesn't want the rules to apply across the board. You just think it's a special set of circumstances for the playoffs.
No, I think in that game, when you're talking about the playoffs, when you go to defensive pass interference and such, I mean, to me, it has to be a very obvious call. And to me, just because the jersey gets pulled away from the body, 5 or 6 inches for a fraction of a second, to me, that does not necessarily warrant a call.
Forget that aspect, honestly, because that would be a holding call. The ref who saw pass interference, and it is a subjective call, but he saw it, and...
Well, maybe he was actually not calling, something that you're talking about. We don't know.
But when he pass interference, to me, if you look and look at Hitchens with his hand on the shoulder, arm extended, and that's part of the rule too, having your hands on a defender with the arm extended, blocking them from an attempt, and Pettigrew is trying to reach for the ball, and Hitchens is holding
him back. The rule book doesn't say anything about having your hands on the guy. It does not say anything about that.
No, but it says contact, creating contact with the receiver.
Contact.
Whether it's the hand or not.
Touching
right?
and contact are two different things, though. Hitchens was not actually moving the body of the tight end.
Did he interfere with his ability to make a catch, in your opinion?
His body positioning, yes.
No. I'm not talking about did he play good defense. I'm talking about...
I thought it was good defense.
I know you did, because you're a defensive player. You know what? We got to take a break. We're just going to get...
here's the thing.
We understand your point of view.
We go round and about on this.
We understand my point
of
view. Okay?
Detroit, just punt the ball more than 10 yards and play defense.
That line of thinking has always bothered me, too, because if the call is played out the way they initially call it, they don't have to punt. It's not their fault. I mean, so yes, they made a bad punt. There are a lot of things. Hey, Matt Stafford, don't get sacked on the last play. Throw a 50-yard touchdown. All right, you could say that about anything at any point.
Or stop Dallas. You had a whole drive to stop
them. I get that. But you wouldn't have to. You wouldn't be in that position, period, necessarily, had that play.
Well, what happens if all of a sudden the call stands and then Detroit continues on their drive and Matt Stafford throws the interception?
You don't know
what could have happened.
Right, and then maybe Dallas fumbles the interception, right? And Detroit picks it up and scores. I mean, and don't think that's crazy, because they pretty much did that on the very next drive. All right,
DeMarcus Lawrence.
We got to take a time out of here. We are going to look at this football team, the Jacksonville Jaguars. Get Jeff's thoughts on the offensive coordinator vacancy, as well as look ahead to the divisional round of the playoffs, where nothing will be whistled as a penalty if Jeff Loggeman has his way. It's Jaguars Today. If you want to get on board today, an easy way to do it. You pick up the phone, you call 641-1010. You can also tweet the show at MD_1010XL, at Logs56, LOGS56, at 1010XL, Fat Tony, at 1010XL, Tyler. Today's fan feedback spotlight question of the day, wishing Keenan McCardle happy 45th birthday. We ask you, in honor of Keenan, some people think he's one of the more underrated Jaguars of all time. Who is the single most underrated Jaguar player, in your opinion, of all time? Tweet your answers. You can call in and discuss as well. Brought to you by Foundation Professionals of Florida. It's a fan feedback spotlight. We'll be back with your calls and more Jeff Loggeman straight ahead on 1010XL 92.5 FM. Here we go, Jaguars Today. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony here with you live at Everbank Field. If you want to get in, 641-1010 is the way to do it. We'll talk Jag football with you. We'll talk offensive coordinator opening with Jeff, and playoff football as well. And as we said yesterday, it's open season on draft talk and free agency talk from this point forward. Team building time for the Jacksonville Jaguars' third offseason for the Caldwell Bradley regime. They'll do it without Jed Fish. We'll get into that in a moment. The fan feedback spotlight once again honoring Keenan McCardell. Happy 45th birthday to Keenan McCardell today. Who is the most underrated Jaguar of all time? Who do you think it is? Send us your thoughts on the Facebook page, facebook.com/Jaguars Today, or any of our Twitter feeds. Jeff, already our little conversation on Dallas-Detroit sparked a little flurry of tweets. Let me read the ones that weighed in on this. Let's see what we've got here. Bad call or not, Detroit needs to shut up, score more than 3 points in the second half, and quit crying.
Agree.
Hashtag Cowboys. That one from at Cato White Music. Okay. You agree with that,
yeah,
standpoint. Then this one from at CO Hop, Jonathan Hopkins. Let's not flag the Cowboys, laugh out loud. Jaguars today or Cowboy fans? I think he's just saying, I'm not sure what he's saying. I think he's saying someone's being an apologist for the Cowboys. I don't think that's the case, but I may have misinterpreted that. He did throw the LOL, just kidding, in there. Let's see.
There were a few that didn't agree with me.
There were let me get to those.
Then. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess Jeff doesn't remember how Warren Sapp was ejected from his last ever game here for basically being in a ref's face.
Helmet off.
Right.
And being belligerent.
You said, though, that you would have understood Dez Bryant being penalized more than the actual play itself.
Absolutely.
So, Jeff's a hypocrite, says Joshua. If the offensive player committed similar contact and had caught the pass, he would be furious.
No.
Your comments?
No, it's playoff football.
This one from Duval Doom. Never thought Jeff was as wrong as I do right now. Wow.
Can you imagine the conversation for the last 2 days if after that play the officials had come out and said no pass interference on the play, no penalty there, Dez Bryant, unsportsmanlike conduct, a 15-yard penalty, and Dallas loses that game? Can you imagine the conversation for 2 days about Dez?
Yeah, it would be about Dez.
Right.
Absolutely.
It should have been called.
Yeah.
Should have been called, but also I think it would have been more because he's got a history of blowing up on the sideline a little bit. You know, it would have been Dez Bryant can't control himself.
He's got a little reputation.
Right, and I think that would have fit right into that narrative. And, you know, everyone's talking about, obviously, waiting for the Tony Romo meltdown, or a lot of people were. And it didn't come. He played exceptionally well.
He played pretty well.
Probably the best season of his career.
Didn't start out very well.
No. No, but I mean, that's a very good defense that they're going up against. The top five against the run and the pass this year, they've been.
I thought that Detroit did a fantastic job controlling the inside. I mean, Ndamukong Suh and the rest of those Detroit Lions front guys, I thought they were exceptional. I mean, that's the first time all year that I was able to see somebody control the line of scrimmage against the Dallas Cowboys in that fashion.
Although Philly in the Thanksgiving Day game, I thought, did the same thing. Not quite in the same way that Sue does it. He does it in a pretty unique way. Boy, just when he got his finger
powerful
on Tony Romo's jersey and yanked him down. I guess that wasn't holding either because he pulled him by the jersey. Just kidding, Jeff. But the best reversal of a call, for Detroit's perspective, they got their reversal last week when Sue got allowed to play. So they were owed a reversal maybe coming against
so
them.
Maybe it all balances
maybe
out.
Maybe it all does. All right, 6-4-1-10-10. Let's get Memphis Mac on the line to start us off today. Mac, how are you? Good morning.
Doing good, Mike. Jeff, I love it. I love the way y'all reconfigured the show. Y'all together.
Mac,
y'all fuss a lot. Yeah, it's awesome. Jeff, I really enjoy you. Are you there?
Hey, Mac, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Jeff, I really enjoy all your comments, but let me say this. You're so off base on this one, brother. I mean, a bad call is a bad call. Now, did that determine the outcome of the ball game? Absolutely not, but a bunch of bad calls possibly could. I mean, the analogies about the NBA let's just do this. What if a Hall of Fame pitcher is pitching to a Hall of Fame batter and you're going to give the pitcher the edge? I mean, just because it's playoff? I mean, a call is a call. I have to agree with Mike totally 100%. That was
I agree with you, Mac, that it was a bad call. I don't think the penalty should have been thrown from the very beginning.
He's trying to turn it around on you here, Mac.
No, I really enjoy the conversation, but I just really think sometimes, I mean, Jeff, on this one, you're off base a little bit, and all due respect to you, because I know you're a Hall of Fame, you should be, a football player, but man, it's crazy. That one right there, brother, I think you're missing the boat. I have to agree with Mike, and I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you, Mac. Not because you agree with me. A serious question now, all right? Clearly, Tony and I can talk football. I feel like we know the game pretty well. We didn't play the game of football. Do you feel like my feeling is, see if you agree, is that the general group of players would tend to agree with you more. Let them play. Forget what the rules say. And when they say let us determine that, my feeling as a fan has always been, yeah, but if you commit a foul or a penalty, you are determining it. It's not the ref's job or fault that he called it. You're determined it by your actions as long as they're calling it properly. But, I mean, clear to me, I get the sense that the players look at the rest of the fans like, you need to have been there.
You got two segments. You got the offensive side of the ball, and you got the defensive side of the ball.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's pretty clear.
So you're being a defensive player.
Of where
player,
they would be split.
You recognize your bias
well,
then.
I just think that when it comes to playoff time, and this is historically has always happened, is that no matter what any kind of point of emphasis has been throughout the year, when it comes to the playoffs, if it's close, keep the flag in the pocket. And then let the game happen. Let the players determine the outcome of the game. I'm sorry, and maybe it's my vision of what I want the NFL to be and to get away from where it's become. And maybe that's part of my, I guess, attitude on this call. And that I like the game the way it was before they started having to where you can't have any contact at all with a defender against an offensive receiver. And so maybe it's just that desire to see the game that I used to love a few years ago before Napoleon influences on the competition.
I'm going to get
committee.
You some VHS tapes from the 80s or 70s.
It's interesting with them deciding that's not a penalty in that situation. They get together, they decide it's not going to be a penalty in that situation. Doesn't every team that in this playoffs is going to have to play Seattle keep a close eye on something like that, because that's been a team that has been accused of mugging receivers, and it gets worse in the playoffs. And New England, you know, the potential matchup of Denver and New England, and that's, you talk about Indianapolis, that's been the big complaint. They talked about it after the Super Bowl last year.
My whole thing here is that, you know, if there was no flag call, if there was no flag thrown, where would be the uproar?
But there was a flag.
But I know, but there would be none.
Well, there would be, there wouldn't be any
in
because
Detroit, there might have been.
It would be we wouldn't be able to pull that one play out of probably a lot of plays where there are 50-50 type calls.
That's my point.
But again, the refs don't, when they throw that flag and draw attention to, usually there's some kind of explanation. Well, wait a minute.
I'm looking at it from the perspective of is that if the flag was not on the ground.
But it was.
What would be the reaction to that? There would be none.
Outside of the Detroit fan base, probably correct.
At the
time it happened, it might have been like, whoa, that guy might have got away with
that one. That could have been called is what the opinion would have been.
Sure, right. But the fact that it was, and that's the thing, once it's called,
I'm looking at it from the perspective of is that to me the flag should have stayed in the pocket on that because it's a close call. It could have gone either way. But where would the uproar be if the flag was never on the ground?
All right,
there would be none.
Let's get a few more of these in. We got them stacked up right now. Mike, you're up next on Jaguars Today. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, the thing on the Dez Bryant, I was listening to NFL Network last night. There's no rule saying that he can't walk out on the field once the play has been blown dead.
Rule. The rule is, the main part of that rule is that entering the field of play without a helmet. And then you're not when it's not your side of the ball.
Right. I think the specific rule that people were citing on Sunday incorrectly was a player can't remove his helmet to argue with the referee. Since he's not in the game, he's not in the process of removing his helmet.
But it's the same thing.
If you run out on the field with a head full of steam and get in the referee's face and argue and you're not even in the game, I think the referee clearly can use his discretion to throw a unsportsmanlike conduct penalty on you. That's my opinion. He didn't, and that's why it is somewhat a discretionary call.
Well, and Dean Blandino talked about it being, you know, maybe Dez Bryant ran out there and says, that was a great call. You guys got it right, and let me applaud you.
Yeah, maybe he did.
Maybe that's what
maybe
he was saying.
Maybe he did.
You know, so I mean, we don't know what he was saying, but you know, if Dez Bryant went out there and was, you know, scathing at an official and it was abusive of an official, I guarantee you that a flag would have come out.
Maybe he ran out there and said, hey, let me tell you what I think about Jeffrey Ireland. You never know.
I really like the way that your hair looks today. What hair product do you use?
Hey, these are my dinner plans tonight.
That's right. Come join me. 641-1010. Leo, you're next up. Apparently, Dez has a gravelly voice, according to Tyler. What's up, Leo? How are you?
Hey, good morning. Happy New Year, gentlemen. I'm so glad y'all are hitting on this topic, man. It's so good. Jeff Loggeman, I'm not here to rip you at all. I'm not here to, like, try to say. I understand 100% where you are coming from. In fact, if y'all go way back to the Tuck rule, I've never seen that rule before, and I've only seen it one time.
Let me just say one thing about that, Leo. That rule was called 10 times that season. Okay, prior to that game, nobody noticed it because it's kind of an obscure rule, but it was called 10 times that very NFL season, just so you know.
I got you. What I'm saying is, though, but like you said, rules kind of change. I wish they would make that. I wish that wasn't like an unknown rule and it would be very clear. The problem, though, like you said, when that referee throws that flag, he saw something. Then they go to the huddle and then they pick it up. That kind of questions the integrity of the game. I'm going to tell you something. That Pittsburgh game, when they were playing the Ravens, and they scored a touchdown late. Now, they were still down, and then they called holding. Nobody saw that holding call. That was not an obvious call. Only people who saw that holding was the referees. But the touchdown came off the board. It made the game less exciting. And I'm just saying, they need to be consistent in their call. Either, I agree with you. They shouldn't throw the flags at all. It's playoff football. Keep the flag in your pocket. But when you throw it, you saw something, but then you had a huddle and discussion, and you pick it up. That makes me question the game a little bit, man. They need to be more consistent with this game. Because, see, no one ever wants to say, oh, well, no one's ever going to question the integrity of the Shield, the league. You know, they're the king. No one's going to question it. But you have to be very, very careful when doing these type of games, man, because people see it, man. I mean, and all they're going to have to start doing, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen now. If they stop showing you, not doing away with instant replay, but if they stop showing the replay after the initial play, then that's going to stop all the questioning. I've seen them do it in a couple games this playoffs. But it's a good topic, man. They need to clean it up a little bit, man. I appreciate y'all taking my call.
All right. Thank you, Leo.
I think it was also kind of crazy that, you know, after the game, all of a sudden, then they start bringing up, you know, well, Dean Blandino was on the Cowboys party bus
right
back in the
but
preseason.
But you know how that's going to go, but that's how that's going to be. That's lunatic fringe notwithstanding. There's legitimate reason to discuss the call, non-call, however you want. Although I will say this. I don't think you should never, after huddling together, reverse your call. There's usually just some kind of explanation because sometimes you see something that from a certain angle looks like, well, he had to have pulled him to the ground. And maybe because you are blocked out, you can't see through the guy's body, another ref said, no. He just happened to trip, and I know it might have looked like that to you, but trust me, there was no contact. Here, you can't argue that there was no contact, because there was contact. Now, maybe he argued and said, I had a better look, the contact was
minimal,
whatever the case may be. I'm not, even though I think that one should not have been overturned, I'm not saying no call should ever be overturned. When you huddle together, the idea is to get it right.
Yeah, they should have done a better job with the mechanics, and they shouldn't have announced the call until they actually talked about it. You know, well, the official that supposedly had the angle that he disagreed with that being a call, that the mechanics of that should have happened before, and they shouldn't have made any announcement that there was a penalty. The proper way to do that would have been to have the huddle, make an announcement, and say, there is no flag on the play. Leave it at that.
Yeah, by the way, some people say, you know, oh, Vegas wants a certain outcome, you know, then Vegas has an influence, and that plays into all the conspiracy theory aspect of it. In this actual instance, Vegas would only be hurt by, I forget how, but they needed Dallas to not score a bunch of points because Dallas, more people would play Dallas -6.5 than the other side of it. And so, Vegas actually was on Detroit's side, so to speak, if anything, you know, in that instance. So that could have potentially hurt them, turning the ball back over to Dallas, giving them another opportunity. Could only hurt the bottom line for the boys in Vegas.
Yeah, see,
if you're looking on the conspiracy level of the nth degree, yeah, I'm tamping that one down for you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sports that I think you can question integrity. I mean, boxing has always had questions that surrounded it. The NBA, at times, there's questions about, you know, the star treatment and what the next television ratings will be. And all of a sudden, how come there's always a Game 7 when it comes to, you know, the finals and everything? And there are certainly questions there, but the one thing I don't ever question is any kind of influence over the Shield. I think it's as a strong of a game integrity that there is, period.
641-1010, you want to weigh in? You're certainly welcome to. I promise you we will get to Jed Fish and his absence from the Jaguars coaching staff, Jeff's thoughts on that, and what direction they should go in terms of what kind of guy they should be looking to bring in here for the next offensive coordinator. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Logman, Fat Tony here with you. It's Jaguars Today on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. All right, we continue on Jaguars Today. Foundational Professionals of Florida providing you your fan feedback question of the day today, which is simply not a question so much as a request of you to give us who you think is the most underrated Jaguar of all time. The tweets keep pouring in on that. We'll take a look at those coming up in about an hour from now. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Wagman, Fat Tony here with you. A couple more calls on this topic we've been discussing, you know, the officiating in the playoffs, specifically the Detroit-Dallas games, but just in general as well. And then let's move on to some more Jaguar-related stuff after that. Let's get Craig up next here, though, on Jaguars Today. Good morning, Craig. How are you?
Good. How are you guys? Happy New Year to you all.
Same to you.
Hey, I like Log's kind of philosophy. It is playoff football, and, you know, You want to see a great game. You don't want the officials to affect the outcome. But, you know, every coach from little kids on up says you don't let the umpire or the referee affect the game. So the Lions had plenty of opportunity to win. And if they won, we probably would have be talking about, you know, why did Romo collapse and what's Jerry Jones going to do in the offseason. But what I want to point out is when the punter for the Lions was backed up in their own end zone, he barely got touched, and they threw a flag, and they got a first down, and they moved the ball down the field. When the Cowboys punter got throttled, you see the back judge looking at it, and he doesn't even throw a flag. And they kind of talked about that, you know, on air. So, I mean, there are calls that we see that the commentators see. Should it be a call? Should it not be a call? You know, I just say let them play the game and let the battle be won or lost on the field.
All right, thank you, Craig. That's fine. I guess when I hear that.
I agreed with both those special teams calls, by the way. I mean, Dakota Watson rolled into the punter's leg. You can't do that.
Right.
And for Detroit, the guy got blocked into the punter. I mean, the Dallas player shoved him into the punter, and by the rules, that's not a penalty.
Right. Well, when you say let the players decide the game, to me, if you commit a penalty, it's not the ref's not deciding the game by calling it. It's you deciding the game by your actions. Now, if the refs are making a bunch of bad calls, that's a different story. But, I mean, whatever. We've said our piece on that.
We'll agree to disagree.
We will agree to disagree on that. Let's get finish up on this topic, though. Let's get Tony up next here on Jaguars Today. Hi, Tony. How are you?
Yeah, how are you?
Good.
The first thing I want to do is I need to offer a bit of a disclaimer. I'm a diehard Cowboy fan, so objectivity be damned.
Right.
But I will say this. The Cowboys being such a polarizing figure, I mean, it's amped it up way to the nth degree. I mean, I can go back to the call in the San Francisco-Seattle game when Kaepernick got – when Russell Wilson – it was a good hit. And it changed the whole complexion of the game. But this was not the last play of the game. We went for it on 4th and 6, converted. They had their opportunity. They didn't. And Craig made a great point about, I don't see where the Dallas player blocked the guy into the punter, and it wasn't a call. So, I mean, technology is so much of the human factor out of the game. When I was a kid coming up, I mean, he led with the shoulder, but it was deemed he led with the helmet. 15 yards, put them in field goal range, changed the whole game. I mean, had the Cowboys lost, like he said, it would have been a whole different story. Bad calls happen all the time. We just have to live with it. But the Cowboys being who they are, Jerry Jones, and the personality of the front office, it kind of blows it out of proportion, I think.
Yeah, maybe a little, to some degree. I don't think it's all that just because it's Cowboy. I mean, I think it's the last game of the weekend. Everybody's watching it.
It was the main feature game.
Right. And I get it. Dallas does have a polarizing effect. I don't honestly, I don't think I really have. I don't care either way. I enjoy watching Tony Romo. I don't enjoy bashing him particularly. You know, if he plays poorly, I'll be happy to point it out. I don't really care one way or the other, but I know a lot of people either root for or against Dallas, and that's so there's maybe a small degree of that.
You know what? I was kind of watching that game, and I remember it was 4th and 6, and before the play, I mean, before the Cowboys have even broke the huddle, if they even did huddle, I'm sitting there going, 4th and 6, who is Tony Romo going to throw the ball to? He's throwing it to Jason Witten. Hello, Detroit. You might want to cover Jason Witten. They had double coverage out to Dez Bryant. You knew it was coming. You knew it was coming. And what a great Jason Witten is going to the Hall of Fame for a reason, for plays like that 4th and 6. Great player. Great player, and I love watching him.
Let's get last call here on the whole playoff refereeing type officiating situation, and then we'll move on to other subjects, and that will be Harry up next on Jaguars Today. Hi, Harry. How are you?
Hi. How you guys doing?
Good.
Good. I think in general with the officiating, I think the officials have lost control of the game a lot. I think they've lost their backbone. A good example, I think, is, and especially in these high-powered playoff games, whenever there's an incompleted pass, every receiver gets up and throws his hand in the air. Now, there's no flag yet, but as soon as he throws his hand up, there's a flag. Now, who's controlling this game?
You're overreacting. I mean, a lot of times when the wide receiver's throwing his hands up, what you're seeing on television is a tight shot. So you're not seeing that maybe that flag was being thrown from 15, 20 yards away and the official was reaching for that flag long before the wide receiver's hands come up. And I you know, because this kind of gets my goat a little bit. People say that about the official. The NFL officiating, to me, is some of the best officiating that there is in all of professional sports. And to sit here and constantly pound the officials, saying that they do a bad job, they don't do a bad job. They do a great job. Are there things that you can question? Absolutely. There always will. That's the human element of the game. And to me, I like the human element of the game. But don't bring up that, you know, a receiver throws his hands up in the air because he's complaining that he should have got a call, and then the flag comes in. Because if you look at the film, in most cases, and you watch the body language of the official and you watch the mechanics, the flag was out long before the hands are up by the wide receiver. He's either reaching for it or he's already thrown it and it's in the air and it doesn't reach the camera shot until the hands come up.
And that may be the case in most cases, but there's a perception, and maybe that's all it is a perception. It's like you talk about Pettigrew needs to fight harder to get through that. It needs to be more demonstrative, or Mercedes Lewis to show,
he needs to fight back to the ball.
Right. Well, but in the case of Mercedes, make it obvious that you're being interfered with, right?
Fight back to the ball.
Okay. But I think that reaction sometimes when you get a guy, even though it's the interference doesn't become more pronounced, you just notice it more because he demonstrates, hey, I can't get to the
football.
He's
fighting back to the ball.
All right, fine. But at the same thing, that's the ref seeing some, you know, demonstration of why it should be a penalty. And I think there's a perception, maybe it's only that the refs see that, because there are times, and it's certainly not every time. Refs or wide receivers throw their hands up on every damn incompletion.
Sure.
They think they should get a flag every time. They don't always get a flag. But there are ones that occasionally, and even the broadcasters say, man, did that come in late? When you see a guy going, hey, and he starts looking, this ref's not going to throw, and he'll turn to every official out there, and occasionally you get that late flag. I think it's Harry played up too much of how frequent that occurs.
Yeah, a little over the top.
I do think it occurs. I don't think it's you know, a complete either-or situation. Refs aren't perfect. They're not.
No, but you know, when you watch the actual all-22 shot, and so you're actually watching the body language of the official a lot of times when people say, well, that was a late call. Because, I mean, there's been many games to where when I'm watching a game, calling a game, and I'll say, boy, that was late. And then the next day you go and you watch the film and you see the official and he can't find the flag and he's been reaching for it.
Right.
Okay. So he was going to throw it. He made his mind up to throw it, but he's having a hard time either getting the flag out or it comes in from a distance. So a lot of times that even I think it's late, it's really not. It's just a matter of when you see the flag.
All right, good interest and good discussion on the subject, though. That was a fun hour. Coming up in hour two, we got this date in football history, the Honda drive around the NFL, and then finally Jeff's thoughts on Jed Fish getting fired and what kind of offense coordinator he thinks Gus Bradley should bring in to help coach the offense. Blake Bortles, obviously, at the top of that list. 641-1010 if you want to get on board. Mike Dempsey, Jeff Loggeman, Fat Tony here with you. It's Jaguars Today on 1010XL 92.5 FM.
And now, this date in football history.
This date in football history brought to you all week by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry. Happy birthday, Keenan McCardell. 45 years ago today, 1970, Keenan McCardell was born, and one of the best Jaguars of all time. You can look at him certainly as an underrated player if you want to. I think by NFL standards, he can fit that category. And we asked you today in the fan feedback spotlight, who do you think the most underrated Jag of all time is? We'll share some of your responses to that coming up a little bit later on in the hour. I had all kinds of stuff lined up for you. Here we go. Here it is. January 6, 1996, Don Shula steps down as head coach of the Miami Dolphins after the Dolphins lose to Buffalo in the playoffs. Shula, of course, the winningest coach in NFL history. How many wins for Don Shula? Lifetime. What do you got?
That was a 247.
Yeah,
that's right. 347.
Put it this way. A bunch. All right?
That's a lot.
Win 10 games a year, Jeff. And how long is it going to take you to get there?
That's amazing,
long,
isn't it?
Time.
But I mean, when did he start coaching? He was extremely
young.
With the Colts.
Yeah, well, back in the.
But I'm trying to remember how
young.
Old he actually
no,
was.
He was a young looking guy, I tell you that. I don't know exactly what he was. And makes a pretty mean steak, at least his representatives do at the steakhouse. Lou Holtz also born on this date in 1937. And Howie Long in 1961. What bad nuclear terrorism movie did Howie Long have a role in? I wouldn't say star.
Broken Arrow.
My man over here.
How do you know
man,
that?
I just do.
IMDb Tony is who he is.
I love Howie Long, man. He's a great guy. Of all the guys in the media, Howie's one of the best.
Just in terms of a guy.
Just being a guy, yeah. Dude. I mean, you know, I've got to know Howie over the years. And, in fact, he's living in Charlottesville, Virginia because of me.
Oh, yeah?
The conversation that we had years ago when I was playing with the New York Jets. And he's thanked me for it many times since then because he didn't know Charlottesville at all.
Yeah.
And at the time, he's retired from the Raiders and was wanting to get his kids kind of away from, you know, that area. And he had some land in Colorado. And I said, Howie, take a look in Charlottesville, because my roommate at the time was his former roommate with the Raiders, Bill Pickell. And I said, you know, I think it's one of the most beautiful places on the planet, Charlottesville, Virginia. I said, be a great place to raise kids and with the university there. You know, I'll hook you up with the guys in the athletic department. And he did it. He made the move there. And he loves it.
Well,
he absolutely loves it.
Jeff Loggeman, intertwined with the fabric of the NFL culture.
I like to say I was the one responsible for getting Chris Long to UVA.
There you go. That's I guess that's a good point, right? And that's why he ended up going there. This state football history brought to you by Dr. James McCall's Comprehensive and Cosmetic Dentistry, featuring the custom fit stop snoring mouth guard. Give them a call at 620-9225 or visit jamesjmccall.com for a complete list of their comprehensive care services. That is this date in football history.
Now the Honda drive around the NFL, brought to you by your Jacksonville area Honda dealers.
Mary Kay Cabot of the Cleveland Plain Dealer reports that there could be up to three teams, Buffalo, San Francisco, and Oakland, that are interested in bringing in both Shanahans to be their head coach and offensive coordinator. Mike Shanahan is interested in getting back into coaching this year. His son Kyle right now is the offensive coordinator in Cleveland. There is a belief that some teams are setting up interviews with Kyle Shanahan right now, including Buffalo and San Francisco, as their potential new head coach, with the hope of teaming him back up with his father in the end. Will he or won't he? Will Jameis Winston enter the NFL draft? His intentions still haven't been made clear. He did say immediately after the Rose Bowl loss to Oregon last Thursday, the first loss of his college career, that he wants to play baseball this year. A couple of big milestones for Jameis today. It is his birthday, and it was a year ago today that Florida State beat Auburn to win the national championship last year, something that Mike and I discussed yesterday. the blow up on the sideline between Jameis and Jimbo, for a player that already has maturity questions, which he clearly does, having his coach threaten to bench him if he couldn't calm down, not a good look for the player.
Calm the blank down, right. Tony.
And we're about to begin this silly season of evaluation for all these players, and for a guy who already has questions about his maturity, it's not a good look, that first real adversity in a game where it felt like Florida State was going to lose, to have your coach have to say something like that
Did I tell you about the bet with Phil Sims that I had?
What's that?
Okay, he thinks that Jameis Winston is great. And he said, you know, he's you know, top pick in the draft, top two pick. I said, he will not go in the top five. And so we've got a dinner on whether or not Jameis Winston is going to be in the top five.
What do the Jets have, number six?
Six. Jets are six.
You may have cut that off right at the right spot there.
I wouldn't touch him for nothing.
I personally wouldn't either, Jeff. I think there are too many issues. And I think just if you strip away all the excess, and I know Oregon.
Now, let me say this, though. Not in the first round, okay? But, I mean, I would absolutely consider him, Johnny Manziel.
Right. Would you hitch your franchise to this guy with a top-10 pick? You're saying no.
No.
And I tend to feel the same way. And if you take away all the off-field stuff, I do feel he's a better pro-ready type quarterback. I think he's a better pro-style quarterback than Mariota's going to turn out to be. That's my opinion.
Maybe.
Maybe Mariota turns out to be the better player because he'll have, you know, less distractions, all these other things. But what about that specific example Tony just brought up? Because we were discussing, was it off the air yesterday?
Yeah.
We were talking about that. Here's a guy who's very emotional as it is, okay, in the way he plays, wears it on his sleeve. You've got a situation. He's never been accustomed to losing. He's never had to deal with it. You go to the Bucs, you go to the Titans, you go to any of these teams, any team that's picking that high, you're going to struggle more than likely early on. Couldn't handle it in the game, where Jimbo basically said, either get your act together or you're getting benched right now because you're just giving it away emotionally right here. Is this a red flag, or am I making too much out of that?
Well, that's one of many.
Right, it is. But it is something that you would consider, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Something you'd look at and say, wow, can this guy handle what it's going to be like? Like Blake Bortles. Yeah, you know, the guy handled a 3-13 season about as professionally and as maturely as you could hope any quarterback would, never mind a first-year player. That, I think, is a question now, at least in my mind, about Jameis Winston.
There's so many questions with Jameis Winston. You're talking about a huge financial commitment, but more importantly than the financial commitment, because, look, with the way the first-round picks are now, you can get by with making a mistake financially. The biggest thing, though, is that can you make a mistake as far as time goes by drafting the wrong guy, making that commitment?
Can you get 2 years to this guy? And
well, it's more than 2 years.
Well, it's not necessarily. E.J. Manuel got a year and a half.
Yeah, but I think with a top five pick or top 10 pick, I mean, to me, that's a minimum 4-year commitment. You know, can you afford to give that time to a player that has so many questions? To me, no.
Yeah, I don't. I probably disagree with you about a minimum 4-year commitment, but that's splitting hairs on the subject. Let me ask you, because we're going to get some calls up here about the offensive coordinator job. Your thoughts on Jed Fish being let go?
It doesn't surprise me, because that's just the way it is being an offensive coordinator in the National Football League. I think it can be surprising if you say, okay, well, they're so young, you know, and they've done something, and I've said this many times before, that the Jaguars did something that you really have no comparison in league history with, as far as committing to that many young guys on one side of the ball so quickly. But I think the biggest issue is that, you know, trying to read between the lines, you heard Gus talk a lot about, and he talked about it on his show with me in here during the bye week, he talked about Sharpie plays on the board. And when he's talking about Sharpie plays, he says, what are the plays that you go back to because you do well? And it never seemed that offensively they were able to develop Sharpie plays. And Sharpie plays are, for example, to go back and you talk about and you look at some of the great teams that played in the National Football League, the Buffalo Bills. The Buffalo Bills ran pretty much two plays as far as running games go. They ran the belly, whether it be weak or strong, and they ran the counter. That was it. It's all they ran. And then offensively, three-step, five-step, and occasionally Max Protect seven-step throw deep. They didn't run a lot of stuff. They played fast with the K-gun, and they were able to execute at a very high level, but they were extremely simple. And you know how Gus believes in defensive philosophy. It's very simple, so they can play fast. And I never got the impression that he was comfortable with the way that they played offense, as far as they didn't have a core of plays that they went back to time and time again, and they never developed any of them. And so that may be part of the reason why.
It's funny, or maybe I'm looking at this from the wrong way, but I think a common complaint about Jed Fish is that he wasn't creative enough. That he wasn't.
Well, no, I see. I would disagree with that.
Well, but that's my point. But that's what I hear, that people on Twitter, I'm not saying that that's the actual facts. I'm saying that's why it's ironic, because you're saying Gus almost wanted them to simplify it and draw it down to a fewer core.
Well, and I'm guessing here. I don't know this for a fact. He never said that. But
understood.
You're trying to interpret some of the things that he said in that bye week about finding Sharpie plays on the board. Now, Jed always came up with a lot of different creative plays. He did it last year with Ace Sanders. He did it this year. All of a sudden, you'd see a team run a play against the Jaguars that had great success, and all of a sudden he would flip it into their playbook the next week. You know, so, or finding creative ways to do things. I think that at some point there was almost maybe too much. You know, when you've got a young offensive line, maybe you try to do less style of protections and just do more basic protections so that you can be really good at it with a young group.
Who decides that? Is that the OC? I mean, is that in conjunction with the offensive line?
Well, the
coach?
Offensive staff puts it together, but I mean, ultimately, I mean, that's the offensive
the
coordinator's
the final
job.
Vote on
I mean,
all
he's
that.
The one that puts it all together.
Gotcha.
You know, and look, you know, the most important thing with an offensive coordinator to me is a belief in your system, a belief in your plays. And, you know, I always thought that Blake Bortles did certain things exceptionally well. And those things were the ability to drop, and I said this many times, drop the ball in a bucket. He's got great touch. He's got great ability to create from the pocket and make things happen. And a lot of the quick game, the quick screens and stuff that he had Blake doing wasn't highly successful. You know, so I would have liked to seen Blake more of a five-step drop back, let the offensive line get good at 1-2 protections up front, and let Blake see the field and keep his eyes, because a lot of the move stuff that they were doing, the bootlegs and stuff, I think that's good, but you also have to be able to run the football more. And I think that's one of the things also, is that you want to have a running game that you can count on. And in the first half of that Houston game, there was 18 pass plays called and 6 runs.
Yeah.
And I remember at halftime going, that's not a good mix when it's a close game. If the game's kind of, you know, maybe getting out of hand in the second half, you could understand that type of ratio. But that ratio at Houston on the road against J.J. Watt, probably not the thing to have.
All right, 641-1010. We've got some folks on the line who want to talk about some of the different things we're discussing here, and you're welcome to do that. We'll take your calls when we return in a moment. It is Jaguars Today. Again, the fan feedback spotlight question of the day. Tweet us at MD_1010XL, at Logs56, at 1010XL, Fat Tony. Tell us who you think the most underrated Jacksonville Jaguar of all time is, in honor of Keenan McCardell's 45th birthday today. Jaguars Today will continue in a moment on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. Jaguars Today, Mike Dempsey, Jeff Flogman, Fat Tony here with you on 1010XL, 92.5 FM. Get Jeff's picks for the divisional round of the playoffs coming up here momentarily. Talking about the Jags offensive coordinator opening. Now, Jeff, in a nutshell, I mean, I know Gus talked about kind of what he's looking for in the philosophy, maybe more of and what you interpreted for what he's looking for, but give me one or two qualifications. Are you looking for an offensive coordinator who has prior NFL experience, who's been a head coach, who's got a track record of developing young quarterbacks? What exactly is tops on your priority list?
Well, I think NFL experience is critical. You know, to me,
I agree.
You've had to have spent time at the NFL level to understand the way that the game is actually played. It's much different than the college game. Very different than the college
game. Is that something that Jed Fish struggled with, you think?
No, I mean, Jed had time at the NFL level. I mean, Jed was in Houston, Baltimore, Tampa. I mean, he's had exposure at the NFL level.
So you don't have been a coordinator at the NFL level, you're saying?
No, no, I don't think so, because I think there's a lot of coaches that are on offense that have a lot of input when it comes to game planning. So I don't think that he's had to have called plays at the NFL level. But the most important thing to me is, first of all, somebody that that has a philosophy that they really believe in and that they're committed to it. I mean, they have core principles that they believe in. And those core principles, I think, are going to have to mesh with what some of Gus Bradley's core principles are as far as his belief in what the offense should be as far as the zone running game. You know, so.
Right. Is that a good idea in your mind? As Gus said, we've, you know, started to build the personnel on this roster to play zone running scheme.
Right.
So, therefore, we're going to stick with that. Does that limit your options? Or
no.
Is that the right thing
to
do?
No, I don't think so. I think, because I think that if you're a really good coordinator, you have the ability to adapt to your personnel based on what your personnel is. But what Dave Caldwell and his crew, and they have committed to, and now after year two, is a type of player up front that's going to be able to move and cover ground. I mean, Luke Jokel, Linder, Bowanko are all guys that can move in space, and that's the zone type running offense as far as the offensive line goes. And play action obviously is a big part off of that. So, you know, but you want to have a guy that obviously may have had some experience developing young quarterbacks or coach somebody at the quarterback position that was able to take them to a high level. But most importantly, that coordinator has to have the ability to lead and have respect in front of the room. I mean, because you've got a defensive-minded head coach, you need to have somebody that can command a room, much like Gus Bradley can command a room when he's speaking, whether it be publicly or in front of the team. I think that the special coordinators are the ones that I have been around. Pete Carroll was one of them. When he got up in front of that room, he commanded the room. And I think if you don't have that guy on offense, you're making a big mistake.
All right, let's get some phone calls here. 641-1010 if you'd like to get on board with Jeff Loggeman. We got him here for another 10 minutes or so. Let's go to Eric up next here on Jaguars Today. Hi, Eric.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Jeff, your breakdown, listen to it all the time, man. Love it big time.
Thank you.
Something going forward, I noticed. A, tight end, because we're talking about him earlier. And I know this relates to the coordinator and the quarterback. But one thing I noticed that all special teams have a solid pass-catching tight end. And going forward with the offensive coordinator, and I'll let you guys take it off the air with your thoughts, what about a quarterback coach, somebody like Randy Fitchner or a guy like Rick Tennyson, who's had success in his own block, but they're more like a quarterback coach. They're not necessarily offensive coordinators. I'll let you take it up there.
All right, thanks.
I think Rick Dennison would be a guy that would, I think, be on a lot of people's radar. I mean, he has been in that zone scheme for a long period of time. He's been around successful offenses. Gary Kubiak, I mean, if I had to pick the perfect coordinator for this team, it would be Gary Kubiak. I think Gary Kubiak is a wonderful coach offensively. His zone schemes are solid. He's committed to the run. He believes in chunks in the passing game. If you can find somebody along the lines of a Gary Kubiak, and Rick Dennison is that, that'd be a perfect fit here.
What do you think about, Greg Roman? Obviously, the connection's made because he has a history with Dave Caldwell. He was thought to be a prime candidate to get the head coaching job. They opted not to wait to interview him. And maybe they, did the right thing by hiring Gus Bradley. And then, of course, Mark Trestman, a bit of a history with Gus as well, and he's available. And at least last year had a great reputation for what he did with the Chicago offense. It kind of went a 180 this season. What about those two in particular?
Well, I think with Greg Roman, it's hard to evaluate him because offensively you're very unconventional with a quarterback like Colin Kaepernick. Now, there's no question that they were committed to the run.
Right.
Because,
also had one of the best run blocking lines in the league for quite a few years.
Yeah, but that makes it really hard to evaluate.
Yeah.
You know, so, but there is a connection, obviously, with Dave Caldwell. The other one, Mark Trestman. You know, I would wonder how good that he would fit. Mark is very different. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I go back to the one that's in front of the room that can command the respect in the room. You know, if he couldn't do that as a coach in Chicago, can he do that with an offense?
Is that one of his shortcomings in Chicago, that he couldn't command the respect?
from what I understand, that was one of the questions with Mark Trestman in Chicago, was being able to command the team room. Doesn't mean he's a bad offensive coordinator, because Mark Trestman is an extremely brilliant guy. I mean, he's an exceptionally smart guy. Had great success with offense pretty much everywhere he's been. He's got great schemes, and he's got a great understanding of offense. He's got a great understanding of what NFL defenses are trying to do. But Mark's biggest weakness is the ability to command room. Now, can you overcome some of that by maybe surrounding him with other assistants that can help do that? Absolutely. But that's key if it's a Mark Trestman kind of guy. Can you get other guys in place that can command that room, or the rooms that break up or break down once the offensive team meeting is over with?
All right, let's go back to the lines. I think Ronald wants to weigh in on. We were talking about Jameis Winston and his pro prospects. Hi, Ronald. How are you?
Hey, good morning, guys. First, I'd like to say I know there's a lot of gloom and doom predicted about Jameis Winston, and yes, he's had some transgressions that are warranted. I'm hoping that the guy succeeds. I would pick him. I just hope he's listening to all this gloom and doom. Everybody's talking about him, and I hope he overcomes it. And having said that, I'm going to talk about the offensive coordinator. I know it's not going to happen. I'd love to have Andy Reid come in and be an offensive coordinator. I know he's a head coach, but I think he'd be perfect here in our situation. And if I may mention one more thing, Dave Caldwell, he made some comments online about he was satisfied or happy with Toby Gerhardt this year. So he said he saw glimpses of success, and I just don't see it. I mean, a solid running game would do wonders for Blake Bortles. I love to see Gurley here. I mean, I think of what Jones Drew did here with a somewhat good quarterback. He had a running game. I think this guy would be the limit for Bortles, especially early in his career.
Yeah, to talk about Jameis Winston, I'm not saying that he's not pickable, but I think there's a range of where he needs to be picked to lower your margin for error, because there is a possibility of error by picking him high.
And if you're a general manager, you know that that is inherent and it's built in. And I suppose, look, anytime you pick a quarterback that high, if he busts.
Well, most general managers, you get one opportunity to pick a quarterback.
Right.
It's not very often you get the opportunity to pick two. You know, so are you going to hitch your wagon to the Jameis Winston cart and say, let's go? Because you're more than likely not going to get another chance to draft a quarterback.
Don't you think someone will, though? I'm not saying whether they should or not.
In the top five, no.
In the top ten.
Maybe.
Guys, I'm interested to see what you have to say about this. Todd McShay said a few minutes ago that Jameis Winston, not Marcus Mariota, is the best quarterback prospect in this year's draft.
I agree.
I'm not saying anything about his talent.
Neither am I. And I'm not saying you are. That's why I said earlier, I wouldn't take him that high either, because you're drafting the face of your franchise here. Okay. And if there are issues, it's going to be so easy to point and say, how did you not see this coming? You know, there's so many risks inherent with that. Now, obviously, you got to take a chance sometimes. His talent, I think, is undeniable. They had way too many turnovers this year, but I think a couple of things he does, he anticipates throws better than most college quarterbacks. All right, I mean, Mariota's thrown a lot of wide open guys. That's great. There's nothing wrong with that, but I think Winston's been asked to make more NFL type throws, and I've seen the ability. You see that replay from behind the quarterback shot, and you're like, how did you see that coming? And he's able to throw one here when the guy's to point A, when the guy's at point B, and they all meet at point C. And I think he's been pretty impressive in that. And I think there aren't many quarterbacks that come into the league that are as advanced in that area as I think he is right now.
No, he's definitely comes from a more of a pro style offense, whereas a lot of the quarterbacks at the college game just aren't in those type of offenses. You know, a lot of them come from that spread. You know, Marcus Mariota comes from a different offense. You know, so, you know, it's very difficult to forecast a lot of the unconventional quarterbacks at the college level for the pro game, because the pro game, you know, Colin Kaepernick sooner or later is going to have to be a pocket passer, because sooner or later he's going to get banged up. And he's going to have to execute an offense with his arm and no longer his legs. His biggest problem, he has not been able to translate to his arm yet. Now, he's still pretty good with his legs, but at some point, those aren't going to be working like they used to.
Regarding Toby Gerhardt and the caller talking about that, honestly, I think the way the team chose to use Toby is part of the reason maybe that Jed Fish isn't here anymore. And that it's something we talked about last week when you were here, and Jed was still the offensive coordinator when we finished up the show last week. But running him on those outside zone plays, when it was pretty clear that was not going to be what Toby Gerhart did well, when they would run him up the middle and let him run power plays, he was successful doing that kind of thing, and they just, they never quite used him the right way throughout the year. I know he was injured too, but not using the guys he has properly. And I think that goes back to that Sharpie play thing you were talking about, just not using the strengths you have the way that he should.
Yeah, Toby's not a zone runner. I mean, he can do it occasionally, but he's a north-south power lead type of back to allow him to get the momentum going. To where he gets going sideways to a sideline, the ability to plant and get north and south is not something that he does well. You know, so was it a great fit, you know, by Dave Caldwell bringing in Toby Gerhart? Probably not. But there is a role for Toby Gerhart in the future to be able to run some of those type of plays and to be a third down back. And he's not terribly expensive. I mean, he does not have a high cap number.
You know,
he's going to come back.
Dave made it very clear that he thinks there's a role for him in the future. Well, he said he's very comfortable at his cap number. If he's nothing more than a third down back and an effective third down back, that's fine. That fits within their plans. A lot of people are in love with the idea of Todd Gurley here in Jacksonville. Do you think the Jags would commit a pick that high? We may have discussed this last week. I can't remember if we did or not. You don't think they'll commit a pick to a running back that high?
No.
And being the top of the second round is right now where – if you're going to get Gurley, that's the hoped-for range.
I think that this draft will be very defense-heavy early on for the Jaguars. You know, you can't commit to any more youth on offense. You've got to commit to youth on defense for two reasons. One, your defense, you want to have young, developing talent.
Sure.
Linebacker, edge rushers, even somebody, a big stud in the middle. On offense, you need to go the free agent route. You need to gain experience on offense going forward.
Let's get Matt in under the wire here before we break with Jeff Logman. Matt, go ahead, please.
Yes. Good morning, gentlemen. I'm curious on what your feelings would be to bring somebody in with Bortles' arm. And, of course, we'd had quite a few injuries with our receivers. But giving someone like Hal Mumme a shot.
Hal Mumme, former Kentucky head coach, ran, as I recall, just a wide-open offense.
I'm going to go back and say it again. You have to have somebody that has experience, great experience at the NFL level. And I'm not talking 30 years. You don't need to go out and sign an offensive version of Wade Phillips. But you need to have somebody that has coached at the NFL level and understands the NFL level game. It's very different than college. It's much more involved. You know, like I said with Gus before, Gus talked about the intricacies of defense at the National Football League. In college, you might have three coverages that you play. You have three, four, five variations off of one coverage in the National Football League. It's a different game. And I'm not saying it's completely different and it can't be learned, but I'm saying that it's a different game that you want to have experience. Now, if this is going back to when you first get hired and you want to groom a guy, that's fine. But right now, you need a veteran coach on the offensive side of the ball for a very young group.
All right, you're getting out of here in a second, so give me winners this week in divisional round. Baltimore, New England, who you got?
New England.
Carolina, Seattle.
Seattle's going to crush them.
You would think. Dallas, Green Bay.
That's a tough one, but I'm going to take Aaron Rodgers.
Going to go with the home team there, and Indy going into Denver.
I think this one's not – I think this is a tough one to pick. I'm picking Luck.
Are you?
Yeah.
I don't know if they can run the ball enough. I know Heron had a big game catching the ball out of the backfield this week. I don't know if they can run the ball enough. I don't know if they can deal with C.J. Anderson right now. Guys had the best last 2 months of any running back in the National Football League.
And for some reason, Peyton is a great quarterback. He has not finished the season strong. He had a bye week. Which obviously is going to help him. But I just, you know, there's something about Peyton Manning in the playoffs at this point where your whole reason for existing, your whole reason
get
for
that next Super Bowl, one
is
more.
Is it all about a Super Bowl, and the pressure that comes with that is immense.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't think Indy is balanced enough to take advantage of it this week.
I don't think Indy's very talented either, but I just have a funny feeling.
This is
about
more an anti-Denver pick for you.
Yeah, it's just a funny feeling about this game.
All right, there he goes. Jeff Logman wrapping up his day with us today on Jaguars Today. He's going to be with us all throughout the NFL postseason every Tuesday. So whether it's talking about the Jaguars coaching staff, vacancies, or player acquisition, the Senior Bowl coming up, all that, we'll get to all those things in the days and weeks ahead. Jeff, good to talk to you, buddy. Happy New Year. We'll see you soon. There he goes, Jeff Logman, everybody, on Twitter, at Logs56. We'll come back. Fan Feedback Spotlight. Your thoughts. Who is the most underrated Jaguar player of all time? Your calls welcome as well. 641-1010. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony, get ready to wrap up Jaguars Today next on 1010XL 92.5 FM. Jaguars Today continues. Mike Dempsey, Fat Tony here with you, along with Tyler Devitt back at 1010XL World Headquarters at 1010XL Tyler. Add that one to your growing list of Twitter handles to follow. Tony, today we asked people in the Fan Feedback Spotlight, brought to you this month by Foundation Professionals of Florida, who's the most underrated Jaguar of all time? Happy birthday, Keenan McCardell, 45 years young today. So we got I love this. We got such a wide variety.
It's so all over the map.
I thought every single one. I said, yep, I can see that. Yep, I can see that. Part of that is what you play in this market, you're going to have a lot of players who don't get their due. So give us an example of what the feedback was.
Here's what we got. And like you said, it's going to be all over the map from Brian. While not long for the roster, I'll say Gary Walker, cap casualty after 2001, big impact the 3 years he was here.
G-Funk.
Yep. From Will, we got Joe Zelinka. From Harold.
No, wait a minute. Hold on. Whoa. is it possible he was the most overrated long snapper in history? How many long snappers even get to know their names?
Whatever one is here.
He was right. Yeah. Carson Tinker, Joe Zelinka. There aren't too many that I recall over the years. So
no.
Continue.
From Harold, we got Natron Means. He put the team on his back when they needed it. Honorable mention goes to Morton Anderson. From Duval Doom, that's easy, and it's the reason I got so angry about the Lions-Cowboys game. It's Rasheen. From Josh.
Don't you think Rasheen is?
I think because of the last two or three years that he was here, a lot of Jaguars fans even have forgotten how good he was.
I think as time goes by, it'll circle back. It was Rasheen's great to Rasheen's, he's terrible. He can't stop anybody, and he's played fairly well. I mean, he's been starting for several years in Detroit.
Detroit keeps drafting defensive backs in the first round, and Rasheen stays
beats
on the field.
Beats them all out, right?
Yeah. From Josh, we got by far Fred Taylor was most underrated in national perspective. Meester locally, hashtag the good old days. From Birder, I don't know exactly how to do that one. Easy, it's Donovan Darius, doesn't get enough credit for being Jags' best safety of all time.
Hear that, Double D?
From Cam, we got Reggie Barlow, was a consistent threat on special teams, haven't had one since him. From Eric, Rob Meyer is probably the most underrated player for the Jags, 7th-round pick, played hard for us, there's no doubt about that.
I agree with that. He may be the single best draft pick, got the most value out of a 7th-rounder. And definitely one of the most underrated players.
From Nick, Daryl Smith, one of the best players in Jags history, hashtag not appreciated, hashtag still playing in the playoffs. And by the way, he's 2-0 on the road against Pittsburgh in the playoffs now in his career. From Joey, nice. Kyle Brady, best blocking tight end in the game for a couple of years. And from Bobby, Vince Manawai and Chris Naoli, our interior offensive line was key in our run game around then, hashtag underrated. By the way, Kyle Brady is still, I think, 5th? All time on the Jaguars receiving
list.
Don't
depress me.
I think he's 5th all time on the
Jaguars
receiving
list. Love you, Kyle. Kyle's a good Jacksonville guy. We saw him not too long ago. I want to say it was in the last month of the season or so.
Yeah.
When David Lamb was doing
20
for 20.
I want to say it's Jimmy Keenan, Mercedes is 3rd, Mojo is 4, and Kyle Brady's 5 with Fred Taylor 6 all time.
Two receivers. You're like the Kansas City Chiefs all of a sudden.
Something
right?
like that.
A couple of quick ones from Facebook here. Eric said, Rob Johnson, if not for his one great game, we couldn't trade him for a first-round pick. which ended up being Fred Taylor. Hear ye, hear ye. Charlie Oscar, no Joe today? Yeah, where is Joe today?
Joe's been quiet today.
He blew the whole thing off. He went with Greg Jones. Seemed like we could put anybody running behind him and get the job done. Fullbacks get no credit. Hashtag, I miss Joe. So, so do we, as far as that goes. Let's get to another call in before we get out of here today. I believe Fred is next up on the line. 641-1010, the number. Good morning, Fred. How are you?
Hey, good, guys. Back when you were talking about Jameis and, you know, his quarterback prospects, one thing that doesn't get talked about enough, I think, is that it's hard to separate all the couple of little things from the big thing that turned out to be nothing, that he did no wrong. I mean, and that's a matter of opinion. I'm sure some people have their own opinion, but he was tried and looked at seven different ways from all kinds of different angles and people. Nothing, no charges, no, and you know.
I tend to agree with you
on that.
Listen, but to me, and I'm not trying. I'll let you finish your thought, but I agree with you on that. He hasn't been tried, but he was vetted by several different levels of scrutiny, both from legal and the school's procedural policies, and nothing came out of that. And, you know, for the people that continue to call him a rapist, I mean, you have his, you know, you don't have the evidence to back you up. Now, I'm not saying, I don't know Jameis's heart. I don't know the guy, but you're right. I think that point has at times been overblown, but I think it's just the general immaturity of Jameis Winston. And clearly he's mature enough to be a player that could be extremely successful at the college level. I'm not doubting that. I just don't know, me personally, if he is the CEO face of my franchise kind of guy that I want to put out there, because at what point do you realize when you are in that spotlight, that intense glare, that even though that jumping up on the table and screaming what you scream may not have hurt someone directly, it's just not very smart to do in his position.
Right.
And it's those question marks about decision making, Tony, that I think, to me, as much as anything, do I want to roll this guy out as the face of my franchise? We look at Johnny Manziel. He just had another run-in with a guy in a Houston bar over the weekend where he's caught. You know, and maybe it's not a big deal, but they're heckling him, and he's going back at him. He's flipping him the bird, and that pictures of that end up on the Internet. And in the end, is that such a big deal? No, it's not, but it's just one more bad decision by Johnny Manziel to, you gotta be the bigger man, you gotta walk away at times. There are different kinds of bad decisions that have been made, Fred. If you're still there, that's more what I'm concerned with than, is this guy a sexual predator running around? I hope he's not, but I don't have any pile of evidence to me indicating that he is, because I've looked at all the evidence in that case as much as has been made public.
Well, that raised his profile as a bad guy. All the other things I think anyone can possibly do in college, but let me tell you the biggest difference. You mentioned Johnny Manziel. Everything Johnny Manziel does makes him look like an arrogant jerk. And Jameis Winston, when you see him with his team, the video clips that you see, he's putting his guys first. He's encouraging him. He is a leader. Johnny Manziel's a piece of you-know-what. There you go.
All right, well, that's your opinion. You didn't know what Johnny Manziel was like at Texas A&M.
Sure.
And I recall that Johnny Manziel never did interviews, practically, when they were at Texas A&M. Until he won the Heisman. And he couldn't have come across as a more put-together, mature guy, I thought, at that point in time. And his actions kind of belie his words.
Look, Jameis Winston won a Heisman Trophy, and even without all the sexual assault stuff, if the Heisman Trophy winner is going to go steal crab legs, there's going to be a story about it. If the Heisman Trophy winner is going to stand on a table and scream what he screamed in a student union center, there's going to be stories about it. And then everything else that we're talking about outside of the sexual assault would be in the crosshairs. And I think that there are people who vilify Jameis Winston unfairly because of those accusations, but the profile would be just as high on this guy with or without that. And it's that immaturity that you're worried about on the next level. It's that you see him on the sideline in the first game where it felt like Florida State was going to lose, and he's out of control to the point that his coach is having to threaten to bench him. In the first game where it feels like this for Florida State, for the first time in his career, it's like, look, you need to calm down or I'm going to put you on the bench.
You need to deal with, and you could say you need to deal with adversity because he's been behind a lot.
Right.
That's one kind of adversity. He didn't deal with that kind very well.
Yeah, it felt different in this game because against Louisville and against Miami and against those teams, it always felt like Florida State was on the verge of being in the middle of that game and winning it. Against Oregon, halfway through the third quarter, everybody watching that game knew what the result of that game was going to be. Florida State was not going to beat Oregon that day. And watching him deal with it the way he did, from an NFL perspective, you can understand why a team would look at that on top of all the immature things he does and say, maybe we need to take a second look at this guy despite how talented he is. And by the way, all the stuff Manziel did was the same thing. I mean, it's the same thing. He liked to party. You're telling me you can't say that there's a bunch of kids in college who like to party?
Right. Well, you can say that, but how many of them keep putting themselves into such a high-profile situation when they're expected to be a top pick as a quarterback in the National Football League? And you can say that everyone does that.
And we'll get through the next 4 months with maybe Jameis Winston doing something else, or maybe he doesn't.
Maybe he doesn't.
We don't know.
Oh, look, I have no I'm a Florida State fan. If he succeeds in the NFL, that's no skin off my back. I'm not rooting for the guy to fail. I'm just trying to give you an honest assessment that I would be skeptical of taking him with my first-round pick as the face of my franchise. I don't question his ability. I'm not saying he's perfect. I think he has all the ability to be a really good guy. They say Ryan Leaf had all that ability, too. He didn't have it between the ears. Now, you can argue Jameis has it between the ears from a football standpoint, but
I hope he grows up because I think he has the opportunity to be a good player on the next level.